guys, and welcome to Drunk Medical Stories, a podcast where two women, who definitely aren't doctors, discuss wild medical stories with the aid of medicinal beverages of the boozy variety. This podcast is rated explicit for language and adult content. We also recommend a strong stomach as we will be discussing the occasional graphic medical condition. Hey, so welcome to another episode of Drunk Medical Stories. I'm Terry.
And I'm Claire.
So this week, we are calling this episode Old-Timey Treatments. So Claire, what medicinal beverage will we be treating this episode with?
Well, I've been treating myself for the last hour, but today, in honor of our title, Old-Timey Treatments, I figured it was only fitting that we drink a old-fashioned. So, yeah, I'm a bourbon girl, so this really sings to my heart. But a little history on the old-fashioned. The first mention in print of an old-fashioned cocktail was in the Chicago Daily Tribune in 1880.
Wow.
However, a gentleman's club founded in 1881 in Louisville, Kentucky, claims that the old-fashioned cocktail was invented there. The recipe was said to have been invented by a bartender at that club in honor of Colonel James E. Pepper, a prominent bourbon distiller who brought it to the Waldorf Astoria Hotel Bar in New York City.
Colonel Pepper. Huh?
I'm thinking that's like the father of Sergeant Pepper and the Lonely Hearts Club Band.
Sergeant Pepper, Colonel Pepper, Lieutenant Pepper, Pick a Pepper,
Captain Pepper. Private Pepper. With its conception rooted in the city's history, in 2015, the city of Louisville named the Old Fashioned as its official cocktail. And there is a two-week celebration in June called the Old Fashioned Fortnight, which encompasses bourbon events, cocktail specials, and a National Bourbon Day, which is always celebrated on June 14th. Ironically, also Flag Day and the Army's birthday.
I knew I loved Kentucky for some reason. I want to move to Kentucky, live in Kentucky. I go to Kentucky all the time. I love Kentucky.
I was actually in Louisville a couple weeks ago. A friend of ours was going to a school there and invited us up to Louisville to do some bourbon tasting. And we went to Old Forester and we went to Evan Williams. It was so good.
Did you buy any from there? I would have bought the whole stock.
This will make sense later in the episode, but they had one called the 1920s. It's their Prohibition era from Old Forester. It was the best bourbon I've ever had in my entire freaking life. It was so good. And not just because I'm obsessed with the 1920s. But yeah, no, Louisville does bourbon right. And I'm convinced that like the wives of the owners of all of the bourbon distilleries went to Napa Valley and was like, oh, we could totally do this. And that's why bourbon tours have totally taken off, is because somebody went to Napa Valley and was like, oh, this is easy. Yeah, we can do this. Let's do this. And now everybody has tours and tastings.
Oh, why not? You know, you have the liquor there. You might as well invite the people to drink. If you have liquor, they will come. You know, so what is in an old fashioned?
So an old fashioned, I actually got this from the Maker's Mark website, so I know it's legitimate.
Yeah.
A true old-fashioned is 1.5 parts Maker's Mark bourbon, splash of water, 2 dashes of bitters, 1 teaspoon of sugar, an orange peel, and a cherry for garnish.
Okay. I'm not a big, like, liquor person. I'm more, you know, beers and well, kind of fruity drinks, liquor. But old-fashioned I've had, I think, maybe once or twice, so I wasn't sure what was in it, but it sounds good with the cherry and the orange peel.
Now it's basically a shot of bourbon, well, a shot and a half of bourbon, but the bitters kind of like elevate the flavor. The sugar gives it that hint of sweetness that bourbon is already naturally kind of sweet, but that sugar really brings it out, and so does the cherry. And the orange peel just gives it that sort of citrusy sour note. And I used to be a really big fan of old fashions when I was little. Old fashions in Manhattan.
When you were like nine.
I was six. And the reason was my mother is allergic to fruit. She can have the cherry in the drink to get like that flavor, but she can't eat the cherry itself.
What?
So I would get to eat the cherry.
So you would get a little kind of taste of the old fashioned.
Yep. So I'd get the boozy cherry at the end. Yeah.
Your mother is allergic to fruit.
All fruit.
Yeah. She had to wear rubber gloves when I was a kid if I wanted strawberries.
Oh my gosh.
To like wash them, she had to put on gloves.
I am so sorry for your mother.
Dude.
That sucks.
Also, she has officially proven that a tomato is in fact fruit because she is allergic to it.
Wow. I mean, I knew that because my husband is a produce guy, but
yeah.
I feel so bad for your mother. I love fruit.
I do too. And, you know, she was a good sport about it. You know, if we ate bananas, she'd kind of, you know, pinch her face and look a little angry, but then we'd be really nice and immediately take the trash out. So.
Okay. Well.
But, you know, I wasn't complaining because I got boozy cherries from the time I was little.
So. Okay. So you've been drinking since you were six. You sophisticated drunk you.
That's me. That's me.
Okay. Well, let's get into old-timey treatments. This has been quite fun actually researching. I can't believe the things that they did, what we call back in the day, which really wasn't that far back, but I'm going to start off first with a definition that I found that they used to call physicians or surgeons. And I did not know this back, 1837 was when it first was seen in a literary book, an actual Charles Dickens novel, The Pickwick Papers. Have you read that?
I've heard of it.
Okay.
My mom's a huge Dickens fan.
So. Yeah. So his 1837 novel, The Pickwick Papers, a character Sam Weller says to Mr. Pickwick, "Don't you know what sawbones is, sir?" I thought everybody knew what sawbones was, a surgeon. So sawbones was what surgeons and physicians were referred to back in the 19th century. Those were for surgeons that used to perform amputations.
Oh, that's awful.
Yeah, so
ow.
I'm going to go send you to a sawbone specialist. And so sawbones quickly became an established member of the English language. And it was employed by such authors as H.G. Wells, Mark Twain, and Robert Louis Stevenson. So, of course, medical technology has improved dramatically since then. Thank God.
Thank God.
Yeah. So, surgical saws are used in procedures today, and that's a far cry from, I'm sure, the weird, crazy, primitive tools that they used back then.
What? I just used this to cut down the oak tree in my backyard. You need your femur cut off? I gotcha.
I gotcha. But the word sawbones is still used, but just in a humorous context. So today's definition word is sawbones. So if you're
going to start calling some of my doctors sawbones.
Yeah, yeah. So if you see a doctor or a surgeon or you're going to go see one, just say, you know, hey, Dr. Sawbone. See what they say.
I'm only going to use that for, like, the really old doctors, though.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Because the new ones just wouldn't understand it.
Oh, yeah. No, just be like, well, I mean, you were learning on the battlefield at Gettysburg, right? I think one of them might actually slap me in the face if I say that.
They might. They might. They might get offended. I don't know. But they might say, oh,
They're good sports. You can't be a doctor in today's day and age with people who come in, I mean, between the bath salts and people eating off people's faces and, you know, people coming in after being revived with Narcan, and they literally wake up in the ambulance, get put in the hospital, and go, I'm out of here, bye, and walk out the front door like... When you deal with that every single day, you have to have a good sense of humor.
Well, you should. But yeah, you...
you can't survive that job without a sense of humor.
No. Not at all. Some of the bizarre medical techniques from history. So I pulled this off of medicalnewstoday.com, and this was published back in October of 18 by Tim Newman. And I just thought some of these techniques from history were amazing. So, you know, as long as we have endured ailments, we have made attempts to rid ourselves of them. And however along the way, there have also been horror, errors, strange decisions and brutality in the medical field and in just every day trying to figure out how to fix illnesses. And the road to modern medicine has not been smooth.
No.
It's still not smooth.
No.
but it has not been boring either. So without further ado, let's take a painful wander down a blood-soaked memory lane. Have you ever heard of the tobacco smoke enema?
I'm sorry, the what?
Yeah, the tobacco smoke enema.
Oh, no.
So clench your butt cheeks. Here we go. So in the late 1700s is when tobacco started to arrive on the English shores from the Americas. And
whoop, whoop.
For whatever reason, the idea came that this tobacco should be used as an enema and that tobacco smoke could cure a range of ailments. As the name suggests, the tobacco smoke enema literally involves blowing smoke up the patient's rectum.
Oh my God, is this where blowing smoke up your ass came from?
I guess it does. Blowing smoke up your ass.
Oh my God. Yes.
The so-called pipe smoker, London medic, would use the technique on those who fell into the River Thames and were near drowned.
Ew, ew. The River Thames is disgusting today.
I'm sure
the River Thames,
gross.
200 years ago?
1700, they dumped, yeah.
300 years ago, even better. They dumped sewage in it.
Ew.
Yeah, people today are like, we need to stop throwing plastic in the ocean. We used to throw feces in the... Don't get me wrong, throwing plastic in the ocean is still bad, but...
Bad.
The vile disgustingness that we used to know.
Well,
the
Thames was like... pee in a bucket and poop in a bucket, and then they would throw it out
a window.
Or throw it out in the river back then?
Yeah, and that's exactly... Yeah, no, it was... Falling in the River Thames, like, part of it was bad because, okay, cold river, bad.
Yeah.
Hypothermia, bad. Also, filled with disgusting bacteria and human excrement, bad.
So, like, choking on shit, bad.
Literally choking on shit, bad.
Yeah.
Like, if the cold didn't kill you, the germs would.
Yeah. So, the tobacco smoke enemas were thought to both warm the patient from within and stimulate, you know, respiration. So the Royal Human Society left these kits that included equipment necessary to carry out tobacco enemas at certain points along the river, just because people kept falling in the river, which I don't even understand that. But
no.
So one particular graphic description from 1746 was described in a paper published in the Lancet. A man's wife was pulled from the water, apparently dead. A passing sailor who was puffing on his pipe, okay, he instructed the husband to insert the stem into his wife's rectum, puff on the bowl, and then blow hard. And miraculously, the woman revived. So word of their benefits quickly spread, and people were soon thinking this was like a miracle treatment.
No, 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 okay. No, 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 because here, like, okay, I'm sorry, if I'm super cold and pass out from the cold, but then somebody shoves something up my ass, yeah, I'm probably going to wake up real fast. It has nothing to do with the smoke they're blowing up there. Jesus.
So they would use these smoke enemas to treat everything from headaches to cramps to typhoid and cholera.
God, okay, so for those of you who aren't aware, when you have cholera, basically you vomit and have diarrhea until you die.
Oh my God.
Like, you dry out like a husk because you are constantly vomiting and shitting nonstop, and it's just awful.
Okay.
I wouldn't want to put something up the anus of somebody with a cholera and then try to blow, put my mouth on something that is connected to their anus, because if they drop a load...
Oh, well, okay. So get this. So people started doing this. But then if a practitioner were to accidentally breathe in rather than breathe out, perhaps during a bout of tobacco-induced coughing, the cholera could pass into their lungs and inflict them fatally. So they would inhale the feces, the rectum juices, the cholera flagrants, or however you say that. And so, thankfully, the introduction of bellows made the job slightly less hazardous, but in the early 1800s, tobacco was shown to cause damage to the heart, and the tobacco enema faded quickly, and therefore, we don't stick pipes up our butts anymore.
Clearly, smoking is bad. Tobacco smoke is bad. All hospitals in this day and age have banned cigarette smoking inside the hospitals. Most have banned it on their property. Well, every year at the hospital that I work at, the entire campus reeks of tobacco smoke.
Like, what?
Inside and out. Why, you ask? Because our entire hospital is surrounded by a tobacco farm.
Oh my God.
And please notice that I have lived in Tennessee long enough that I no longer say tobacco, I say tobacco.
Tobacco?
Tobacco. I haven't gotten to tobacco yet, but we're getting there.
Oh, and we forgot to disclose at the beginning that we are not doctors or nurses.
Like, my boss is a doctor. The people I work with are all doctors. I am not a doctor. I flunked out of nursing school.
Yeah.
I have a semester and a half of nursing school under my belt, which is about enough to, like, survive a zombie apocalypse, but it's not getting me into med school.
No. Yeah, and if anybody would like to, after we tell our episodes, you know, if we say anything wrong, incorrectly, or would like to prove any of our stories, please, you know, we'll give our email at the end, but we are not doctors or nurses, so we do not want to say that we know it.
Yeah, we cannot provide medical advice.
No.
But we are willing to receive medical advice.
Yes, if you would like to freely give your services to check out my wart or my mole that I
was asking for stories, but that's okay.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry. Okay, next story, urine therapy. So, that's a different podcast. We are not that podcast. Okay, so today urine has few everyday uses. I mean, people will say it does. Some people say it doesn't. Anyways, I'm not going to debate it because there's people that like things. But anyways.
No, the only person I've heard of is Bear Grylls, who drinks it instead of water, which is super gross.
Yeah, so I'll get to that.
Okay. God.
So in Roman times, however, it was a different story. Urine was such a popular commodity that people actually collected it from public urinals, which I don't really understand that statement because how did they have public urinals in the Roman times? I thought they just peed in the street.
No. I think the Romans are actually fairly, they were the first ones with indoor plumbing.
Okay. So there was even a tax to pay for those who profited from the sale of this golden liquid. That's crazy. I could make some money off pee if I lived back in the day. But I could understand the use of urine that was non-medical. Kind of like they would use it to soften leather. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
They would use it for like gunpowder.
Really firing off your load there, huh?
That's not pee.
On guys, it comes out of the same hole. So
Okay.
We're grown-ups, I swear.
Yeah.
I'll stop making penis
jokes. I swear to God, this is only my
I just keep drink. Topping off my glass with bourbon. Okay. I don't know. The
don't
bottle
know.
Used to be a lot fuller. I can't feel my face.
I can't feel my tongue. It's okay. Okay, so one less savory use for urine, however, was a teeth whitener. The ammonia allegedly helps clear teeth of their stains. So imagine it would do nothing to reduce your morning breath, though.
Apparently,
leaving the urine to fester for some time gives the urea time to convert into ammonia, which is an antibacterial and bleaching agent used in household cleaning products. So it was not only the ancient Romans who used this teeth whitening method throughout history.
No.
It has been used by a number of people, and even today, some are tempted to give it a try. And I would like to clearly we do not recommend this.
No.
Do not try this at home.
I'm sorry, did my 15,000 no's not get that get that across yet? Like, no. It's disgusting.
So, I know. No. So these are a few things that I heard that urine benefits, but then I read that it actually does not benefit. So I'm going to read three things. I heard peeing on jellyfish stings.
That's a real thing. It works.
I heard that it does. It makes them worse. So if anybody's out there that can clarify that by email at the end of the episode, please email us and let us know. I heard it's worse. You hear it works.
I'm not going to say this is from personal experience, but I'm also not willing to say that it's not from personal experience. No. But I grew up in South Florida on the water.
I think it makes it worse. They say it makes it worse.
I will say, actually, true story for those of you who want to know, this is not official medical advice, but this does actually kind of help. I did try peeing on it. It seemed to help. But the one thing that really, really, really helps is meat tenderizer because it breaks down the proteins.
Okay.
So if you have like crystallized, sorry. Anyway, continue. What else does pee do?
Urinary tracts still hold bacteria. So urine itself isn't always sterile. So I've heard that people say, oh my God, your urine is sterile. It comes out of your body. But you still have bacteria in your urinary tract.
Unless you're drinking a solid diet of cranberry juice, I can guarantee you've got some sort of something. And even if you do drink nothing but cranberry juice, you probably have some little critters multiplying in your urinary tract. So
yeah. And then peeing on feet to cure athlete's foot is just silly. I mean, peeing in the shower is not silly because you don't waste water. You're just peeing while there's water. Peeing on your feet just to cure athlete's feet, I think, is silly.
Ew. I didn't know that was a thing.
I didn't either, really.
Okay, you know what? I have never been able to write my name in the snow with pee. I don't get to pee on trees. I don't get to pee next to the car. It's the only time in my life that I get to pee standing up. And damn it, I'm going to take it.
I know, right?
No, I got a Shiwi. I had a Shiwi, and I was so excited to use it, and it did not work, and it was awful, and I had to use a scarf that was sitting in the back of my car to, like, dry my legs off, and then I had to throw the scarf out, and I was so mad because it was a cute scarf, and it was awful. Oh, my. It was so bad.
Remember this fact. Urine is liquid your body is throwing away. It filters out nasty stuff that it can't use, which is why we pee in the first place. So I have tons more, but I'm going to tell you two more, and then we will get to your stories, because I can't wait to hear them. And my mouth is getting numb from the 6-7 drinks I've had so far.
It's okay. I literally can't feel my cheeks.
Okay. So have you heard of bloodletting?
Yes.
Okay. So have I, which I didn't quite understand until I read into this. So much as it sounds, it's the process back in the day where they would basically withdraw quantities of blood from the body, which they thought was in order to cure anything.
Literally anything.
Yeah. So like you had syphilis, let some blood. Headache, bleed you out. Kids giving you hell, let's bleed you
them out. Actually, you know, if you bleed out the kids, it actually might take away their energy, so maybe they'd be calmer.
Yeah, it might take them out completely. What are you talking about?
Bleed your children very carefully. I'm kidding. Don't bleed your children. Holy shit.
No, that's not recommended. So, believed to be one of the older medical practices around, spanning some 2,000 years until the late 19th century. So it's like one of the oldest, but not the oldest, medical practices around. So
yeah,
practically bleeding oneself to death doesn't seem like the greatest of pastimes. But in those days, the belief was that the blood could be used up, that it didn't circulate as we know it does today, but rather that it stagnated in certain parts of the body, causing illness. That it was like almost like water that stayed in a pot too long and mildewed. And then if you let it out, you know, you're letting out the mildew or whatever. So the other key belief was that the body contained four substances called humors.
I knew that.
Which consisted of blood, black bile, yellow bile, and phlegm. So an excess or shortage of any of these substances would result in an illness. So naturally, the best cure was to let some of it out if there was too much phlegm or too much yellow bile or black bile or too much blood. I don't know how you could tell, but this is what they did in the 19th century, or I mean the 17th, 18th century. So I have a little bit of history, and I actually heard this on some news and then I read up on it. At 67 years old in 1799, they actually bloodlet President Washington when he fell ill. So he was out riding his horse. It was wet. It was cold. His clothes were wet. I guess he got a cold or a flu or pneumonia or something. I don't know the specifics. No. So they decided to bloodlet him. Well, they removed a total of more than 80 ounces of his blood, which was 40% of his total blood volume in over a 12-hour period. Just a 12-hour period.
Wow.
And guess what? He died like 2 days later.
That's what killed Washington?
Well, there were some other things they did to him, but they bloodlet him over a 12-hour period and took 40 ounces of his blood volume from his body.
Now, the question is, can they take 40 ounces of adipose fat from my body? Because that would be much appreciated.
Yeah, really.
Just let that go?
Just let it drain out.
Actually, you know, I didn't even tell the best part of the bourbon story.
Oh, okay.
So, under the umbrella of Jim Beam, they have a bunch of different bourbons, right?
Okay.
One of the bourbons they have is, well, it's actually two. It's Basil Hayden and Old Granddad. Old Granddad is the rot your gut, rip the lining off of your esophagus whiskey that's like super cheap, great for when you're young and don't know any better. Old Granddad will get you drunk quick and it'll do it cheap. So if you were to use the Johnny Walker spectrum of colors, Old Granddad is Johnny Red. When you get into the nicer sipping bourbon, you get into like the Johnny Black era, that is Basil Hayden. Basil Hayden and Old Granddad are the same guy. Basil Hayden was everybody's old granddad. As it turns out, Basil Hayden is my old granddad. He is my eighth great-grandfather.
What?
Eight times removed great-grandfather.
You're related to somebody that...
I got bourbon in my blood.
So where's the drink? Why are we not, like, living at a distillery, like, showing tours and drinking bourbon?
Because my asshole family sold Basil over to Jim Beam.
Oh, my gosh. I want to go back in our time machine.
Right? We need that time machine, though.
We are getting that time machine.
So Basil is now owned by Jim Beam, and I will say Jim Beam has done old Basil well. So they have the standard that you'll see in most stores. They also have a red one, which is a dark rye, and then they have a blue one, which I think is like a Caribbean rye.
Wow.
And I really wanted to get it, but Louisville, when I was up there, they had it out of stock, or they didn't have it in stock. That makes more sense. But yeah, if you want a really good sipping bourbon,
yeah,
Basil Hayden is your guy.
Awesome. Well, I know someone famous. Okay, so I have one.
I tried.
So, God, I have so many, but I can't because we, like, you know, I want to hear your story. So I've got one more, real short, and then I'm going to give my final saying. Okay. Boop, boop. So this physician, we have a physician here that actually took malaria and took it to treat syphilis. So treating one disease by knowingly giving patients another incredibly deadly one sounds insane, but that's exactly what Austrian physician Julius Wagner Jauregg did in the 1920s. He won a Nobel Prize for this effort. So what he discovered was that malaria-induced fevers could help treat syphilis. So he would give his patients that had syphilis malaria. But of course, considering the fact that malaria kills you, his patients would die.
I'm going to put on my shocked face. Well, I mean, to be fair, that would mean that they were no longer suffering from syphilis.
Very true. And he won a Nobel Prize for this, for discovering this, for his efforts. that he would give malaria to his syphilis patients to treat the syphilis, but therefore his patients would die of malaria.
Can we, like, retroactively take that away from him and slap him in the face? Just like, no!
Okay, so here's my final thought. When we look back at today's medical practices, not we, because in 100 years, we're not going to be alive, but our kids, what current procedures, drugs, behaviors, or therapies will send us reeling with shock? I mean, only 20 years ago, it was normal to smoke cigarettes in restaurants. It was normal to drive under the influence of alcohol until the 70s. And in the 60s, pregnant women regularly drank alcohol and smoked. I remember my grandma telling me she would have a glass of red wine almost every day when she was pregnant with my mom.
Oh, yeah. No, my grandmother smoked all the way through my dad's pregnancy.
Yeah. I mean, what are we doing now that will surprise us in a few decades? Humans are excellent at assuming that they have finally got it all worked out. But we never have. I mean,
no.
We always come up with new things and better things. And so through each is horrid in its own way. They remind us of how far we have come and how far we have still yet to go. And that is my stories.
And thank God nobody is coming at me like, oh, you got PMS cramps here? Let me take a pint of blood. I'd punch a motherfucker in the face.
Let me give you malaria for your cramps.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Do you have pink eye? Let me cure it. Want some smallpox? Like, no, get the fuck out of here.
You got a hangnail? Oh, let me just give you some mercury to drink that will take care of you.
Yeah, just drink the mercury. It's fine.
Yeah, it's fine. It's fine.
Got a headache? Anthrax.
Oh my god.
Okay. So, speaking of weird medical treatments, I actually found a really great CBS News article that just had like really weird old-timey treatments. And when we're talking old-timey, we're going straight back to ancient Egypt, friends. We are going way back there. So the ancient Egyptians actually made a paste for toothache pain.
Mm.
Take a wild guess what their paste was made from.
This is Egypt, so clay.
I was thinking scarab beetles.
Ooh.
I was wrong, although on the right track because it was an animal.
Okay, so snakes.
Dead mice.
Oh, okay.
They ground up dead mice and would place it to their cheek to help with their toothache pain.
So they would grind them up, like, just hand grind them until they were, like, a pulp. And then they would just smear it on their their mouth.
Oh, God, you say you say that makes it so much worse. Yeah, that was the thing. And here's the thing. The ancient Egyptians weren't the only ones who thought that dead mice could cure shit. In Elizabethan England, they would cut mice in half and then apply the half-dead mouse, the half of, like, the cut side of the mouse to whatever needed treatment. And they thought this could treat smallpox. They thought it could treat measles, treat whooping cough, and my personal favorite, bedwetting.
What?
I'm sorry. If I was a bedwetter and my mother came into my room and said, you're a bedwetter and we are going to cure you by putting a dead mouse to you, you can guarantee I'd never pee the bed again because I don't want a dead mouse on me.
No, I don't want a live mouse on me.
And also, can we appreciate, like, I know they didn't know about bacteria and germs.
No.
But they were literally applying a dead mouse from Elizabethan England. So we're thinking, you know, lots of shit going on here that's not real good, and a lot of diseases, like the plague, are traveling via rat and mouse. And we are then taking that infected animal and applying it to an open sore.
Didn't the rats during the plague time have all the diseases?
To be fair, it was the flea upon the rat.
Oh.
But yes.
Okay.
I mean, I would assume that the rat would also have the black plague, because the flea has the black plague, and then the flea bites the rat, gets the black plague, and then bites a human and gives the rat's plague to the human, and that's how the black plague got around. But if anybody actually knows the answer to that, please correct me. Okay. Also, it's really hard to read right now. Words are dancing. Okay, so we actually had, I found another Jesus Christ, I'm like clicking things. I'm sorry. In the 18th and 19th century, they actually found a cure for stuttering.
Oh, okay.
It was called a hemiglossectomy. Hemiglossectomy.
Oh, okay.
You know what an ectomy means?
Is that to cut something? Ectomy, like cut off?
Take away.
Take away.
Yeah, so like hysterectomy is to cut out your uterus. Hemiglossectomy is to cut out your tongue.
Like the whole thing or just...
Like the whole thing. So good news, you can't stutter anymore. Bad news, you can't talk anymore.
You can't talk, you can't stutter, you can't do anything.
So in their defense, highly effective.
Okay.
But
I don't understand how that could... Oh my God.
Yep. Oh, you're stuttering. The devil must have your tongue. So we will take your tongue away from the devil. So, you know, on the one hand, certainly effective. But they did have, you know, significant side effects. One was, of course, pain. A lot of pain because, oh, by the way, it's the 18th and 19th century. We don't have general anesthesia yet. We have gin. And I don't even think they would, especially if it's like a poor client, you're not going to be like, yeah, let me give you my very expensive alcohol to, you know, numb it up. No. Give me that shit. I'm taking clamps. I'm taking a knife and some patients would bleed to death.
Okay.
Because they don't know how to cauterize. So like, you know, no big deal. So again, curing actually the stuttering, but questionable methods.
Again, you're doing one thing but causing another.
This is gonna be a thing now.
If somebody
offers me a stupid fix for something, I'm gonna be like, no, this is like treating syphilis with malaria, and they're gonna look at me like I'm nuts, and then I'm going to recommend our podcast and they will understand.
Be like, okay, you gotta listen to season 1, episode 2, Old Timey Treatments.
And you will understand.
You will understand the malaria to syphilis, you know, scenario.
Yeah, and also then you will realize how dumb your recommendation was.
Yeah.
But, you know, as I drink more of it, it's not unusual for alcohol to, oh my God, I'm actually slurring my words. I haven't done this in a long time. I was not this drunk last episode. This episode is more fun. So it is not unusual for alcohol to be seen as medicinal. I mean, even today we use it as, you know, a disinfectant or an antiseptic. We even use it in mouthwashes, although apparently that's now frowned upon.
Yeah. But, I mean, I can't imagine right before work swishing a bunch of alcohol and then going into work and then being like, you smell a little boozy. I'll be like, oh no, it's just my mouthwash.
Honestly, I'd be tempted to just drink it.
I swallow, I don't spit.
I'm not touching that with a 10-foot pole.
I didn't mean to say that.
You said it. And you said it on air. And it's hilarious. And I'm going to tell our editor to keep it in because it's hilarious. Get rich, son.
Oh, God. Okay. Whew.
So while Terry is swallowing and not spitting. So signs of medicinal alcohol date back as early as the 6000s BCE in northern China. They actually found jars of medicinal alcohol, which is, by the way, it's notated that it is different from like the drinking alcohol. There's, you know, the let's get fucked up with our buddies at the bar alcohol, and they're the let's go to the doctor and get treated alcohol. Very separate. The Romans actually used wine with frankincense or myrrh. Throw a little Jesus in there, to help dull the senses prior to a surgical procedure. Why the fuck weren't the English using that for cutting out tongues? God damn it. Even the Romans did.
Settle down.
I want to know why people weren't getting sedated before their tongues were cut out. And then, ironically, in England, gin was used to treat a whole array of gastrointestinal complaints, stomach aches, constipation, all that good stuff. You know what fixes it? Alcoholic juniper berries. God, it's like drinking a Christmas tree. I love it.
Oh, Merry Christmas.
Like, honestly, it's not bad if you throw some tonic and a lime in, but I cannot drink gin. I don't know how the gin thing took off in England. Like, it was the most popular drink there. I think it's just because it was dirt fucking cheap.
Yeah.
But I'm sorry, I digress. Oh God. And I just scrolled now to find my spot again. Whew. So for those who enjoyed drinking to cure things, and if you ever visit our Facebook page, we actually have a Scottish quote on there. It's an old school Scottish proverb, and it is, "Whiskey will not cure what ails ye, but it fails more agreeably than anything else." And we find that quite true. And, you know, people have used alcohol to cure any number of things from gastrointestinal issues to depression for years. I mean, I did that all the way through my college years. But Prohibition was a dark time for those of us who like to treat what ails us with drink. However, for those who could afford it, medicinal whiskey was in fact available. Because like I said, I went to Louisville a few weeks ago and they mentioned that Prohibition was super rough for them because Louisville was, it's a bourbon town.
Yeah.
And when you shut down all the distilleries, okay, that's hundreds of people losing their jobs, maybe even thousands. Like,
well, yeah, that's a big
like
deal.
Outlawing wine and looking at Napa Valley. Like, okay, there's a ton of people that pick grapes out there. Like, that's an issue. So, right. Now, everybody today knows that doctors make a significant amount of money. Doctors have always been good at making money because being a doctor is a very important job. You keep people alive, you keep people healthy, and as a result, you get paid very well for what you do. So that was no different during Prohibition, and the doctors managed in the National Prohibition Act of 1919, there was in fact an exemption for medical providers to prescribe alcohol.
Yes.
And for those with enough money to afford the quote-unquote medicine. There was also an exemption for sacramental wine. Yeah, I want to know how many people became Catholic during Prohibition for that weekly sip.
I baptized me today. I'm going to church. Amen.
Hey, man, that's the only thing that got me through basic training, okay?
Amen. I need my wand.
They actually did submit a list of ailments that alcohol treated. There were approximately 27 of them. And that was what convinced the government to allow doctors to prescribe this alcohol.
Is headache included? I'd be like, I got a headache.
God, I freaking hope so.
I need some alcohol.
Yeah. But the bottom line was that alcohol sales provided the physicians with a little extra income. And it was a fairly significant income. When adjusted for inflation, the prescription for a bottle was $80.
And what year was this?
This is the 1920s.
$80 is probably like $1,000.
It's $80 in today's money.
Oh,
it was,
oh, okay.
It was $6 back then.
Oh, okay.
Man, I wish I had $10 to bring back to the Prohibition era. I'd be rich.
Again, we need to get in our time machine.
We need a time machine. Hashtag let's get a time machine.
Yes.
Also, I'd like to thank whiskeywash.com for providing that information on the outlawing of – they actually did a whole article on what was whiskey actually treating during Prohibition.
Yeah.
And during the Evan Williams tour, the lady flat out said she was like, the bottom line was if you went to your doctor and asked for medicinal whiskey, if you could afford it, you were going to get it. And you could get a bottle for every member in your family, even the babies. So you have 7 kids.
You need
I mean, that's 9 bottles of whiskey. Now, however, if you keep in mind, 9 bottles of whiskey times 8, that's $720. Do you really want to be dropping that on booze every month?
Oh my gosh.
I'm not going to lie. When I first saw that, I was like, $80 in booze a month? That's a lot of money. And then I thought about what my wine budget is every month. And I was like, never mind.
No.
That's fairly standard. Fairly standard.
I think I can afford that. Yeah.
That's what keeps me employed. Mm-hmm. Weirdly enough, is because if I didn't have alcohol as an outlet, I would be more of an asshole at work and then I'd lose my job. Anyway, so as I said, you had to be able to afford this medication and that alcohol is good. Exceptions were made for those in power. One of my all-time favorite historical figures is Winston Churchill. And Terry and I actually discussed this before we even started filming the episode. And I was actually going to say this quote, and I was so glad that you learned it because it made me so happy. But Winston Churchill, my dad used to tell this story all the time. And I don't know why. It does not paint Winston Churchill in a good light because the guy led Britain to, you know, victory in World War II.
Yeah.
But there was this time where Winston was drinking. I think he was drinking like scotch or something. And he's throwing the drink back. And this woman goes up to him and she goes, "Mr. Churchill, you are drunk." And he looks at her and he blinks and he goes, "Yes, well, I may be drunk, but in the morning, I shall be sober and you shall still be ugly."
I love it.
To everyone who says that our current president is a mess, you're not wrong. But he is far from the first president to be. I mean, Winston Churchill was such a wild card.
Oh, like, my God.
The man made his appearance based around cigars and alcohol. Like, that was his thing. He was a spectacle, and he reveled in it.
Yes.
To the point where, even though he knew that he was visiting the United States, which had prohibition.
Yeah.
He had apparently gotten hit by a car in New York at one point, and it left him with fairly significant back pain that was ongoing, you know, for the rest of his life. And so he needed something to treat the pain, as one does. And of course, this is before we had, you know, Oxycontin and what have you, and before the opioid crisis became a thing. Although, I do want to break in and say, doctors were treating shit with some crazy stuff because, like, they still had cocaine in medication and laudanum. Say,
laudanum. Heroin was, or something like that back then, right? Yeah,
laudanum was literally laudanum. Opium.
Okay, yeah.
It was liquid opium, and there were opium dens where people were just getting stupid fucking high all the time. But anyway, so he went to his doctor for a prescription for, quote, an indefinite amount of alcohol.
Yes.
An indefinite amount of alcohol.
I want that prescription.
I would be much more fun if I was allowed an indefinite amount of alcohol all day, every day. And thank you, Mental Floss, for this bit of information. I appreciate your article on Winston Churchill and his prescription. To be fair, I could have used that in the 1930s. I mean, you have the fallout from World War I. You've got the ongoing World War II. You've got the rise of the mafia. You've got prohibition. There's a whole lot of stuff going on. So, like, I totally understand it. But as you and everybody, I'm sure, well knows, during the Prohibition, we had speakeasies where it was illegally sold alcohol so that people could, you know, still get drunk at a bar. Churchill apparently visited one of those, but he said it was only, quote, as a social investigator.
But didn't you have to know people or know where they were? Yeah. They were top secret. So if you weren't in the crowd and you were just some Joe Blow, you know, that wanted a drink, and you know, you didn't know where to go, you didn't know where those speakeasies were, then you had to try to find your fix somewhere else or on the streets.
Well, yep. But I imagine if somebody like Winston Churchill says,
he knew everything.
Do you know somewhere to drink?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
If people would be falling over themselves, like the mafia would be like, yo, Winnie, want to come in here?
Oh, they probably approached him. He never asked. They probably approached him.
Oh, yeah, no, somebody was like, I heard you like the whiskey. Would you like some whiskey?
We got some whiskey. I don't know why.
I don't know why I have to say whiskey.
Whiskey.
But it's like that southern accent where they pronounce the WH in everything, the what, why, whiskey.
I like it.
I'm going to start calling it that from now on. Can I get a whiskey and Coke just to see how many people look at me? For the record, Noah, I am not President Underwood from House of Cards. Please don't look at me like that. But anywho.
I like it. I like Winston Churchill and his whiskey. I can't say it like you. I'm horrible at accents, so.
It is a blessing and a curse. Jimmy, my husband, is about ready to kill me because when we were driving up to Louisville, we were running a little late because Jimmy forgot. If anybody is ever interested in time zones, not that you would be, but if you are, look at the line between Eastern and Central Time in Kentucky, because it is not a straight line. That shit, it looks like it was drawn by somebody who grew up in the state where bourbon was invented.
Like, it was
so fucking crooked.
Why would a time zone be crooked in the first I don't know. Okay.
Yeah. No, it's so bad. Like, I get that it's going between counties, but it's so fucking crooked. So we forgot that we were going back an hour or forward an hour, whatever it was. So we were going to be late for our bourbon tasting. So we had to reschedule. And this woman calls, or I call the woman to, you know, reschedule. And she goes, "Hi, welcome to Old Forester. How can I reschedule you?" And so I, of course, I fucking hate it. My mom does the same thing. I come by it honestly, but God help me. My initial response was, "Well, unfortunately, we're running a little bit late for our bourbon testing. And I was wondering if you could actually push us back by a couple hours." And she was like, "Oh, honey, that ain't a problem. Yeah, let me just look at, oh, we got 3 o'clock open. Would 3 o'clock be all right for you?" And I'm like, "Yeah, that'd be absolutely fine, darling. Thank you so much." And I hung up. And I look into the driver's side of the car, and my husband is just staring at me, and he's like, "Where the fuck did that come from?" And the thing is, my husband, he grew up in New Jersey, and he's got a southern twang because he lived in Georgia for 5 years.
Oh, my God.
So he's got a twang. He sounds southern as all get out. When I tell people he's from New Jersey, people are like, "I'm sorry, what?" And also, I now notice that I'm talking in a significantly more southern accent. I can't help it. Let me try and... No, it's the alcohol now.
Okay.
You get me drunk around Cubans? Oh, man. My 2 years of college Spanish come back with a bang. But anyway, I imitate accents. It gets worse when I drink. We are completely off topic now. This is fantastic. But that was my story. Winston Churchill had a prescription that I will forever be jealous of. And yeah.
I think we should try to go to our PCP, our primary care physician, and say, "If Winston Churchill can have a prescription for alcohol, so must I. I demand one
for now. Science.
I need a prescription for whiskey.
I have a severe anxiety disorder. My anxiety is significantly better when I am intoxicated." I go from introverted to extroverted like this. All it takes is apparent. I don't know how many shots it's been. It's got to have been like at least six. I am not a very big person. I'm only like 5'2.5". This is a lot of alcohol.
Oh my God. Well, I think we are done with this old-timey treatment episode, and it's been quite interesting. I love it. Episode 2.
I would like to state very clearly that I am very glad I don't live back then.
Oh my God. I'd be dead by now.
There's a reason the life expectancy was like 45. Also, I'm very glad that A, I have never had syphilis, and B, if I ever did have syphilis, I didn't have syphilis in the 1930s when they were treating it with malaria.
And if anybody says, "I'll treat you with malaria for your syphilis," say, "Fuck no."
And if you ever have malaria, drink lots of gin and tonics because tonic has quinine in it.
Okay, well, that's it.
We made it. I almost fell out of my chair like twice, but I didn't, so we're good.
I choked a couple times, so... We're good.
Yeah, well.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Until next episode. You ready for the outro?
I'm always ready for the outro.
Okay, well, you just snap and go away.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Drunk Medical Stories. We hope you had a great laugh and maybe learned a little something to... No, we don't want you to learn anything from this episode. Please forget everything we talked about the doctors used to do, because it is bad and you shouldn't do it. If you enjoyed the episode and this podcast, please help us spread the word. We'd love if you would subscribe, rate, and review. It'll help let people know we're out here. Sharing is caring. If you don't have anything nice to say, well, then don't bother to say anything at all. Don't leave a comment, and just don't listen again. Easy peasy. Our cover art was designed by podcastdesigns.com. Our sound editor for this episode was Tim Nice. If you'd like more content, check out our Facebook group, Drunk Medical Stories Podcast. If you have a story you think we would like, send it to us at dmspodcast@yahoo.com. To respect privacy, please remove names and places from your cases. If you like your story, we might just feature it. Until the next episode, remember, never treat syphilis with malaria.